jazz.
Busted.
All right. Well, when I was talking about dubbing software, clearly it must be time to start this episode because I've
got
interesting things to say. So welcome to Jazz Bastard episode 154. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And today we're doing a Chicago special. Was it a Kurt Elling recording you wanted to discuss that kind of got us started on this?
When I had back a couple of 3 months ago when I was prepping for the Sextet show, I made a run up to Lou's Used Records in Escondido for Southern Californians. That's probably the best place for used CDs south of Amoeba Records in Los Angeles. And Elling is just a must-buy. If I see something by him used that I don't have, I get it every time. And I found this disc live in Chicago at the Green Mill from 1999 and was very taken with it. And so, that was kind of the inspiration. The thought was to kind of do some Chicago folks from prior to the Chicago young person renaissance that's going on now. I mean, there's some overlap. Right. I think Elling and some of these other guys, Ed Wilkerson, has recorded with Nicole Mitchell. So there is, you know, there's some connection between these generations. But yeah, we're looking at a generation of musicians, you know, one or two generations before the recent Chicago Renaissance, as it were. So, and what's interesting is, you know, Elling's live date, he's very much a man who cares about tradition. And so he brings in a lot of these guys to play with him live, which is apparently something he did regularly at his Green Mill shows, steady regular gig up on Lawrence Avenue in Chicago at the Green Mill. Yeah, the idea was just to kind of look at some players from a little bit older from the Chicago school, as it were. And we have connections with two of them. We actually know two of them.
We do, right. And who is the vocalist? Patricia Barber, another widely recorded
vocalist.
Yeah,
we could have done it before.
Yeah, and she's... was a Green Mill regular. I don't know if she's still up there. She might be.
You know, when I was there in the winter, she was there and I didn't get up to see her. I saw her playing a couple of dates and I wanted to go. And then it was in summer and I didn't get to go for whatever reason. But yeah, she still plays up there. I know she was there last summer.
Okay. So the other artist we chose, and Elling is born in 1967.
He's our age.
He is. And I just checked Nicole Mitchell, exact contemporary. She's also from 67. So.
Wow. But she seems like, you know, a much younger player, right?
Well, certainly her Elling is kind of what we'll talk about him. We've talked about him before. You know, his models are maybe a little bit earlier. He's certainly very inventive, especially in his earlier career. But the tradition he's in is kind of long established, where Nicole really, to be honest, is reaching back to. And we will talk about a recording she appears on, though not one she headlines. So the other recordings we're doing, a couple earlier avatars of Chicago jazz, Fred Anderson, the tenor player, his album Missing Link was released in 84, but recorded back in 79 on the Nessa label. Von Freeman, Doing It Right Now, which came out, let's see here, in 1972, when Von was 50 years young.
Yeah.
And that was his debut.
He's on the Elling date another right. 28 years later or whatever. You know?
Right. Now, he appears there, and he only passed in 2012, but he was a fixture in Chicago for decades. And I think probably both of us have seen him live there one time or another.
Yeah.
Known as Vonsky.
Yeah.
An eccentric. We've talked about his sons, Chico Freeman, before.
Yes.
And he's got a brother, George Freeman, who's a rather eccentric electric guitar player. Vaughn's a kind of eccentric tenor player. And then finally, we're going to do a date that really doesn't have a leader by a group called Frequency on the Thrill Jockey label from 2006. Ed Wilkerson, the tenor player, appears on that. Nicole Mitchell, whom we've talked about before. Harrison Bankhead on bass. And Avril Ra on percussion. So that's a
who
group.
Is no relation to Sun Ra. But
okay. There you go.
I immediately checked that. I was like, what? And I had to know. I had to know with a name like that. It was important for me to know. You know, I was just thinking about this Nicole Mitchell thing. And, you know, maybe in part it's because Elling kind of hit it in the 90s early. He broke big on Blue Note early and started getting awards or nominations for awards immediately. Whereas Nicole Mitchell's career has taken a little longer.
That makes sense,
To get on the boil, which is nothing to do with her talent or, you know, level of talent. But yeah, for some reason, I thought she was like a generation younger. That's just really interesting. Wow, how cool.
She certainly plays, and there is a younger generation yet who we've looked at recordings by.
Yes.
So I guess my thought was we talk about the tenors, move on to frequency, and then end with Kurt. Does that sound okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, I guess we could begin with Vaughn because born in 1923, he's got a few years on Fred Anderson.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. That man has been around. He played forever, didn't he? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Jesus.
Well, again, when your debut is when you're 50. You know, he'd seen some action by that point. And the producer of his album, Doing It Right Now in Atlantic, at that time was Rashawn Roland Kirk.
Yes. And do you think he was fiddling with the knobs on the control on the soundboard? Or?
Well, Freeman, and this is a quartet recording, Sam Jones bass, Jimmy Cobb drums, so well-known names there in the rhythm section, and then John Young, a colleague from Chicago, on piano. And this is one of the more, there's only a handful of albums with Freeman on them out there, especially Freeman as a leader.
Yeah.
Several of them are live dates. This is, I think, if you want to kind of, I don't know if mainstream is quite the right word, but kind of a sampler, a basic introduction to him, probably a good place to start in that it's relatively polished. He plays in a different, couple different modes. It is a big label production at the time. But this is a guy who is eccentric, who a lot of people felt was undervalued and did not get the attention he deserved, but never widely documented. He was kind of just known in the city. Everybody knew about Vaughn, and he was kind of one of the city's secrets. So what do we have to say about Doing It Right Now? This is an accessible place to get him from 72. Vaughn's born in 1923 and dies in 2012. So his story was by no means over now. But this is, again, an unusually late debut for a player. Thoughts on Doing It Right Now?
Yeah. One of the first things I noticed is, you know, he has almost no vibrato. Almost none. Very little. And am I being picky? But, you know, let me just be clear. I like him a lot. But am I being picky by saying sometimes it sounds like the intonation is not pristine?
Yeah, well, there's a great Freeman quote I found somewhere reading about him where he's telling younger players, he's like, don't tune up too much, baby.
he doesn't always sound as if he's exactly in tune.
No, microtones are his friend.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know, and I think that my sense with him is, it was about expressivity and about looseness. It was not incompetence, but, you know, a reviewer described his tone as hoarse. And I think that's a good, you know, it's not a pleasing sound immediately.
No.
I mean, it's a personality. As you get to know him, he's a very lovable human being.
Yeah.
But his tone is not immediately entrancing, let's say.
Yeah, my sense is that he has almost a kind of... He sounds a little bit like a rough and ready blues player, except he's playing a lot of bebop licks, right? So he has that kind of broad, brassy, hoarse tone that you might associate with the kind of rough and ready R&B or even a rock and roll style. Sometimes I hear a little Clarence Clemens here, you know?
There you go.
But he's altogether like 10 times the player, you know, no diss to Clarence Clemens, you know, but Clarence Clemens was, he's not Vaughn Freeman. Vaughn Freeman has some chops. He can do some things, but yeah, he doesn't sound like someone who is particularly interested in, yeah, he doesn't really worry about tuning up that much, does he?
No.
Another thing I want to point out about this date, even though we're talking about Freeman, is the piano player is very good, isn't he?
Thank you.
he's extremely good, and I've never heard of this guy. Have you heard of him before?
No. I mean, my sense is they were running buddies back in Chicago, but another player that never got really a national profile. But yeah, no, they mesh well, and of course, the rest of the rhythm section is blue chip.
Yeah, the piano player gets a lot of run here, a lot of room to play, so which is pleasant to hear. Yeah, I like Freeman. He does have a kind of boozy, affable tone. Do you like him as much as his son, Chico Freeman? Let me put it that way. Just be bold and bald about it.
Wow. I think Chico is a much more obviously accomplished musician who is a little bit more integrated in the idiom, a little bit less just eccentric.
Right.
And I've probably listened more to Chico in part because there's just more product out there. I mean, Even this album, even Doing It Right Now, which is another one I've got, this is a studio thing. I don't think I've ever heard an album by Von Freeman that really sounded like a quote unquote studio album, not in the sense of sound quality. I think this sounds fine, but vibe. I mean, just any album he's on has a bit of a live feel to it. He doesn't strike me as somebody sitting thinking, what's my next concept album going to be about? You know, it's just like,
right,
I'm going to blow some. And so, yeah, I think what's amazing about him is that his way of building a solo is not predicated on any of the well-known masters. He's not a structuralist the way we're used to encountering. He's got this amazing, you know, he'll tongue notes and with this incredible rapidity. He just does things on the horn that most players don't do. And as I said, there's that kind of microtonal sour vinegary sound he gets where he's kind of, you know, ducking and weaving and bobbing around the pitch. So yeah, he's an interesting player, but mm-hmm. I don't know that he's my favorite. You know, it's just he's distinctive.
Yeah, you know, another thing I noticed is on some of the longer cuts, he takes a while. I don't know if this is quite the right way to put it. It feels like he takes a while to get warmed up. He tends, especially, so this album features several songs in the under 5 minute range, and then everything else is around between 7 and 8 minutes. And on the longer cuts, I invariably find myself liking him more later in the tune as he gets up to more complicated work on his solos. Does that make sense? A good example of that would be Portrait of John Young, which has this kind of lugubrious da, 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 kind of very mournful, dirge-like kind of melody. And then by the end, he's really putting it through its paces. He's doing some pretty cool stuff. I mean, he is kind of a straight out of the bebop school kind of guy. And he's kind of got his feet under him. He's got his legs under him, and he's doing more stuff by the end of the song with those solos. On the shorter numbers, there isn't as much time for him to get going. But like on Sweet and Lovely, right, his solo, which, you know, he's playing a ballad there, his solo picks up in intensity and warmth as he moves along. And also on Brother George, another longer number, his playing gets more and more busy, I guess, toward the end. I wonder sometimes if that has something to do with dropping out while the piano player takes his, because the piano player is on from the moment the cut starts. I don't know. It's just kind of interesting. I always think that his later solos on this album are better than his earlier solos. They're busier. They're a little more engaged. They're a little more, it sounds like he's, I don't know, fully committed, whereas he often sounds in the statement of the melody and in his first go at a solo less engaged, maybe, is the way of putting it. I don't know. Did that strike you at all?
Well, I think I was not that clear structurally about that happening. I want to go back and listen to him, but I think maybe subconsciously you're describing with much better analysis than I reached why I had that sense of this being a live feeling album. I mean, that is, you know, he's pacing himself in the way you would for a club date rather than when you're in the studio and you want to kind of get to it. You want it all to be your good stuff because this is what you're putting down as part of the record, literally, you know, the record of your career. And, you know, you want those expressions to be pretty pointed, pretty succinct, kind of your best moves. You're not pacing yourself for 2 or 3 hours every night at the club. You're trying to get it down in 45. And maybe you've identified in a way that I didn't, but I want to go back and listen for him doing that in practice in real time and kind of saving it till he gets going, as you say, on these tunes in a way that a player that was more comfortable and focused on his studio work would try to say, you know, that third or fourth minute of the solo is what I got to start with, you know, because I'm only a little, informal, kind of discursive. Again, the kind of feel you might get from a club date, the second set, rather than, again, the idea that you're in the studio trying to get something, a concentrated representation of where you're at artistically. That's kind of an essence boiled down. Yeah.
I also want to know who is the person who calls out at the end of the last number. That's it. It's time to go. I want to know if that's Vaughn or if that's Roland Kirk and someone told him time's up. You can't rent the studio anymore.
No idea. You know, and I don't know if Roland, I mean, Roland was, I have not checked the dates. I'm assuming Roland was on Atlantic this time. He certainly had a tenure there.
Yeah.
And I know that he got him. Whether he had anything to do with his production or was in the room, I don't know. I know that the story goes that he's the one that kind of got Vaughn signed for what was clearly a one album contract. He didn't say, oh, we found gold here and record seven more. It's like, okay, well, we've done this. Paid you back. Roland.
All right. We've made Roland happy. And
there
so
we go. And right, Ronnie, we can off just, you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a song out of the eight songs, five are originals. And then Sweet and Lovely is kind of the most obvious or best known of the standards. The first time ever I saw your face never quite recovers from what Vaughn does to
no.
it. I like it, but it's like, oh.
But if that sounds like something that Roland Kirk would have picked.
It
you know,
does, and you know,
because he picked stuff like that to play himself on his own albums.
Well, and if you listen to Roland Kirk on tenor, their tones aren't that far apart. You know, I think he is that sound that he gets on the horn is probably closest to the well-known major players to Kirk than
right.
anybody else I could think of. And then Lost in a Fog, Fields McHugh is not a tune. I mean, I love some of their stuff, but I just, you know. So in other words, he is not pandering to his audience in 72 and picking out, other than First Time. I love it because that very sentimental song kind of gets sweet and sour when Vaughn's through with it. There's kind
right.
of, you know, it's no longer a saccharine.
No, it sounds like a lament.
He's clearly not trying. There's nothing desperate about this record. Like he's trying to get an audience or make a popular career for himself. It's just kind of a odd little set list that again, he might've cobbled together for any one given night. So yeah, you know, I've got a couple other albums I was enjoying. Have No Fear, which is a four-song set that I picked up somewhere. And I've got like a live album by him where he does, of all things, Footprints. But yeah, Vaughn is, he's a character. He's a presence. I don't know that he's somebody I listen to a lot just for pleasure. Just, you know, to rack up an album to kind of sit back and sip wine to.
No, you drink beer to listen to Vaughn Freeman. You drink beer or something harder. This is not, he's not a Chardonnay guy, right?
Right, yeah. Beer and unshelled peanuts, maybe. I don't know, yeah.
Beer, unshelled peanuts, or, you know, beer with a shot chaser or something. He's that kind of guy. Yeah. No, this is a lot of fun, and probably the best way is to think of it as Roland Kirk without all of the multiphonics and all of the extra horns and the whistles. He's kind of in that affable, friendly, soul, R&B, but with bebop licks bag. That
Right, and every now and then he'll go out. I mean, He's
just
not,
a little, yeah.
He's not an out player. It's just that he's somebody who, and this is probably not the best showcase of that, but if he feels like just playing a line that doesn't match with the chord, he just does. Not because he's trying to make a statement or show you the shape of jazz to come, but just because he feels like it. Just like when he's in tune. He's like, well, you know, we don't want to get in the way of the expression, baby. You know, so he's kind of free in that sense. He's not a free player. He's not an avant-garde player, but he is somebody who just is not that worried about breaking rules. If he doesn't feel like following them, he just kind of ignores them. He does what he wants to do. Vonsky does what Vonsky feels, you know.
Right.
He was like, one more beer and another record. And you got to love the cover. Vonsky, in the glory of his 50 years and a wife beater, standing there with his axe in what looks like a really rough alleyway with a bunch of crap in it, you know?
Yep.
It's like, yep, this is the 70s back when we didn't have to dress up. We were taking our picture for record.
You wonder if Roland Kirk took the picture.
Now, come on. It's in focus. Come on.
Sorry, and we should mention, for those who aren't paying attention who don't know, Roland Kirk is blind. So there
There
you
you
go.
Go. That's right. Don't ever get a ride from him.
One of my favorite moments was one of his live recordings where he comes out and he plays the number, everyone's clapping, and he's like, "My God, we were backstage getting high. When I came out here, I was totally blind."
What a nut. Somewhat in this tradition.
Yes.
Well, are we ready to move on to Fred Anderson?
Let's do Fred, who's altogether a more serious dude in some ways.
Yeah, so this isn't live, right?
Is it? I don't think so. Hang on, let me pull the disc off the shelf. I forgot. Hang on a second. No, it's not live. I sort of knew that, but no, it's not live.
Because this is again an album recorded in 79, released in 84. It's another quartet: Larry Hayrod on bass, Hamid Drake on drums, and then Adam Rudolph percussion. So there is no chordal instrument. Fred on tenor sax, and there are four lengthy performances here. All of them, I mean, I don't know, 15 minutes or so. They're quite substantial. And there is a sense of, even though it's not live, there's a little bit of a sense of the kind of feel of a live date because the performances are so extended. At least for me. I mean, there's, you know, the sound is good and everything, but it's this kind of weird, very, let's see here. They're 16, 14, 17, and 14 minutes long. So yeah, they kind of, I don't know. One thing about this album I've been thinking about is this duration and how Fred strikes me as in a very different way, like Lee Konitz, a horizontal improviser in the sense of not just not playing on the chords, not playing, you know, arpeggios, but in the sense of his improvisations don't seem to build the climaxes. They seem to kind of go along for the most part. He's not heading somewhere as much as kind of exploring ideas over the course of the time. I don't know if you had that feeling from him. Talk a little bit about
Fred. Yeah, that's fair. We should say a little bit about the shape of his career, because like Vonsky, the shape of his career is a little odd.
And he's born in 29.
Yes.
So he's a little younger than Vonsky, but just a few
years.
Yeah,
and he's gone now too, right? He passed away.
Right, yes.
But he enjoyed, as Freeman did, a kind of late career renaissance, except his late career renaissance, he was like rediscovered by people like Ken Vandermark and became, you know, championed on the Delmark label, among other places, so that guys would come. There's a date where I think Vandermark gets Peter Brotzman to come to Chicago to play with Fred Anderson.
Oh my.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's there you go. So Fred Anderson has a kind of second half career. He's a freer player. He's a more out player, more absolutely out player than Vonsky is. And so he's championed by a different set of people when he has his late career renaissance. But for a long time, he was the owner, proprietor, barkeep of the Velvet Lounge in Chicago, which is a place that was a place that people like Vandermark could go to play live back in the 90s.
And it was South Side Chicago,
yes,
right?
This yes.
was
a
neighborhood bar.
Exactly. And so he was a barman for a long time, even though he never put away, he never stopped playing. He never, you know, got rid of his horn or anything. But yeah, it was later kind of rediscovered, or attention came to him anew, right? I kind of feel like when I listen to this, Fred Anderson has a bunch of albums that are duet dates. And he's got a couple of discs that he does with Hamid Drake. And he really strikes me as a player who really likes to play with just the drummer. Like, he doesn't need a piano player and doesn't really need the bass player that much. He reminds me a lot of very late Coltrane, who wanted to just play off of drums, although much freer player from the get-go than Coltrane ever was. So, yeah, this is kind of a love affair between his horn and the rhythm. What I was kind of struck with most of all on the album was the final number, Tabla Peace. Thank you. which is this very meditative, sweet number after three rather thorny, more difficult numbers. I wouldn't say that the first three numbers are like crazy out. They're not. It's just that they're a little more challenging, a little more, I don't know, thorny, rebarbative, whatever. Whereas tabla piece is gentle, a kind of dirge.
And more meditative.
Yeah,
right?
very mellow. So anyway, Anderson can be way more out than he is on this particular date. And he's not that far out here. And this really is, I think, just about the drummer and percussionist laying out space for him to do whatever he feels like over that. And what he does is pretty interesting. I like your description of his being more of a horizontal player. I think that's kind of fair. I don't know. I mean, his other stuff is much more aggressive and attack oriented than this is. This is almost mellow. I think I mistakenly described the first three tracks as very out or very or more aggressive. Ballad for Rita, the second track, is actually quite meditative as well. It's not a ballad as far as I can tell, if by ballad we mean a sweet love song from one person to another, but it's mellower.
Right.
Much more mellow and calm and meditative. So yeah, the sort of, you know, neither one of them are burners, but the more aggressive tracks here are Twilight, the first number, and The Bull, the third number, and then the second and fourth numbers are kind of mellower and quieter. This was a substitute for what I had originally wanted to listen to, and when I listened to this again, I was struck by just in general how different it feels to me to other Fred Anderson stuff that I have. I've got a chunk of this now. I'm just collecting them for a while. And the Penguins, weirdly to me, compare him to Gene Ammons. And I wanted to ask you about that. Do you hear that? Do you hear Gene Ammons in his playing? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I actually did check on their entry just out of curiosity and kind of get oriented because I've heard some and enjoyed some Fred Anderson, but not a player I've immersed myself in, not somebody that I've got a deep library on or a lot of knowledge about. And I don't know this particular album. What struck me the most is how slippery it was. Every time I put it on, it would recess. It was always enjoyable, but I had trouble focusing.
Yeah.
I would lose track of it. My mind would kind of slide away.
It's a big boy headphones, think hard album. It's not background,
yes.
Or because then it will become background.
It does.
I think it's a percussion because you suddenly feel like you should have your shades and your beret on when you hear the percussion.
Yeah. And it is this a little bit for an quote unquote avant-garde player, the bed of percussion along with the drums, it sets up more of a hypnotic groove than you're used to. You tend to think of, you know, an avant-garde power trio, say Spiritual Unity or something, where everybody's bouncing off one another like molecules in a highly excited formula, not the sense of kind of a bed that things happen over. And this is more in that kind of meditative, almost a world music groove than it is the more intense Sturm und Drang players questing against each other and with each other to see God's face kind of stuff. And he's just, again, he's mellow. He's not really playing a lot of atonal licks. He's not squealing. It's just kind of, it's not completely in. It's not real recognizable chord progressions. He's not playing out of nowhere or something for 15 minutes. And it just kind of, it just unspools. And it's pleasant. I think there's good musical content there. You know, if I listen to him, I don't think, oh, what a vapid player, or they're just spinning in place. But the minute I let my attention drift at all, it snaps into the background. And I start losing track of what he's doing. Because I don't really think these performances have markers. There is not a sense of structure of, we're in the middle, we're at the beginning, we're at the end, we're at the climax. You know, it's all kind of on a plane, as Kurt Cobain would say. And it's a very good plane. I mean, I like it. It's not unproductive, but it's like 15 minutes pass and then it's done. But you don't know, okay, we're in minute 14, all hell's going to break loose now. It's just kind of percolating along. So, yeah, I need to go back because I think some of his other stuff has made more and stronger impression on me. And as you said, he seemed more aggressive later on, more willing to kind of push boundaries, where this, which is apparently maybe his second release. And again, he's not somebody who started recording prolifically at a young age. He kind of really gets into the studios more in his middle age and goes forward. So I like it. It's pleasant. I think certainly if you're a little bit dubious about out music or atonal playing, this would be a place where you could get to know him and it would not drive you nuts. I mean, I don't, like I said, any moment to moment, I don't hear that much playing that really seems that harsh or atonal or challenging.
When people think of AACM musicians, because that's a Chicago-based movement of really aggressive out music with polyrhythms and so forth, when you think of that kind of music, you forget that sometimes associated with that could be sort of mellower stuff. So in my collection, I've got an Ethnic Heritage Ensemble's The Continuum. And Khalil Al-Zabar, who plays on the Elling disc we're going to talk about in a minute, he's playing percussion on that. And I think Joseph Jarman is on that disc as well. And you think, oh boy, here we go. And it's just fucking as mellow as can be. It's like meditative and groovy calm. Like there's that other side of the AACM that we don't always think about. And this album is in that bag for the most part.
Definitely. You know, it's not the little instruments, varying textures bit of it, but certainly in that it's meditative, that it's unspooling kind of at a leisurely pace, and it's not trying to startle you or freak you out. To my taste, I probably think it might have been more productive if this album had been the same length with, you know, six or seven songs instead of four.
Sure.
But it depends on your goal. I mean, especially that last track, which I think was a bonus added, you know, back in the LP days, it would have only had the three and then they added the fourth here. Its goal may be a kind of meditative state or almost trance rather than, I don't know, an unspooling narrative kind of music that has more dramatic structure to it. That's just, I don't think they're trying for that. But the result of it for me as a listener is it sometimes gets away from me.
Right.
You know, we're talking about the AACM and the little instruments tradition and meditative music. Are we ready to move on to frequency?
Let's do that. And let's tell the fans how we know one of the main players here.
Well,
because they don't care, but we
story.
Care. Yeah.
They don't care, right. Years ago when we went to grad school at University of Chicago, various people would show up for the noon basketball games. And those always went on a long time because if you weren't playing basketball, you had to be working on your dissertation or reading modernist poetry or something equally tiresome. And one of the players was Ed Wilkerson. He would show up.
Yeah, he was a regular in the games. You know, about 5'8", good point guard, good shot. Faster than he looked, and always right. Always friendly, just a nice guy. He was one of some people who you played in the noon game with, they were assholes, but Ed never got upset. He was just cool. And I remember the first time he told us how old he was, I was like, holy shit, because he looked 25 years younger than his age. I just couldn't believe how well preserved he was. He was striking.
Ed born in our first two players born in the 20s. Ed was born 1953.
Yeah.
So, and,
you know,
a little older.
Yeah, he was like, what, 10, 12 years older than us. But he looked our age. I just, the first time he told me his age, I was like, what? No way. You know, he's like, I'm 37. I'm like, no way. I was 24 or something.
And way back on episode 9, we discussed the Eight Bold Souls album. And Ed was the writer and leader of that ensemble, Last Option. So if you want to hear about a much, not a lot earlier work, but another work of his that he appears on, that's episode 9. That's right before the Deathless Weather Report episode number 10. we're still recovering from. So anyway, we have touched on him before. And of course, we've also talked about Nicole Mitchell, who appears on this album. It's kind of a, I don't know, a left of center Chicago supergroup of sorts.
Yes. Describe all the players. Name all the players here.
So yeah, Nicole Mitchell, flute. Wilkerson's on tenor sax and clarinet on this album. Harrison Bankhead, bass. And of Real Raw, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name. His first name is Avreeyayl.
Yeah. Who knows how that's pronounced? Avriel? You know, it could be anything.
Yeah, I was checking. It's like, obviously, Patrick, you mistyped on the keyboard. There's too many vowels here. And then I checked. Nope, that's the way it's spelled. Yep. You did it right. So, yeah, this group was a Thrill Jockey release.
And is that's a Chicago label, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And it's that was a label that they recorded. They also did pop music, didn't they?
Yeah, I think.
I know they did some Chicago bands.
The C and the K.
C and the K. Okay.
Which is a weird kind of light pop band with a really good rhythm section, impressionistic lyrics. We did their album Everybody back in episode 21. And they are Chicago based. Archer Prewitt, I think, also. There's a whole bunch.
They do pop as well as Jen.
And I'm not sure if Tortoise might have been on Thrill Jockey.
I think that sounds right. I think you're right about that.
The kind of post rock instrumental group.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So yeah, Thrill Jockey has a broad remit, as it were. And so that's kind of cool that this appears on Thrill Jockey.
And we did talk about Nicole Mitchell's Black Unstoppable back on episode 32, which is another Chicago-centric episode. We're big fans of her. She's moved out west, but she was a Chicago fixture for many years. So yeah, this record I had not listened to for a while, and it's an example like the Living by Lanterns album that we did a while back. I don't think quite as successful as that one, but of a one-off album that, by having a quote-unquote group name, is almost unfindable if you don't know what you're looking for. It's one of those projects that I think is just completely sunk out of sight because very few people know who Ed Wilkerson is, unfortunately. I think he's a really good player. But nobody knows who Frequency is, right? It's just, you know, again, this bad idea of trying to give a jazz group a rock-style name. And then unless you're really successful, it just becomes a weird footnote. So what do you think of this outing as I eat some M&Ms here?
That's fine. I was just looking up bands that I'm aware of that have recorded on Thrill Jockey. Our 11th Dream Day, Caliphone, Chicago Underground Duo, Tom Verlaine, of course, Tortoise, and a band that I like that I mentioned in a previous episode, Future Islands. I think Jeff Parker also may have recorded with them. So yeah, they started out as a New York label and they went to Chicago, and a lot of Chicago small bands played on different things with them. So there you go. There's that. So this reminds me of like a mellower version of The Missing Link. It's basically what I think when I think of Frequency. The percussion is really prominent and enjoyable. So what I like about this album, there's a couple of things I like about this that jump out at me. I do like the meditativeness of some of the songs. I think the bass player is terrific. I love how the bass player is mic'd. I can hear everything. It sounds wonderful. I love when Ed and Nicole play in unison, as they do on the open of a couple of numbers. They do it on the first number, Pitiful James. They do it on the Tortoise. They do it on I think they do it on Satya. I can't remember now. There's one number where Ed's playing clarinet with her flute in unison.
Right. I think it's Pitiful James, I believe, that first number.
I just like that sound. I think it's cool. And of course, they don't do it for long. It's always an opening statement, and then off they go. So this is not super stressful. It's not super high energy that often, which isn't to say that makes it sound sleepy. It's not. So like the Tortoise is a good example. They have that kind of open together, Nicole and Ed do, and then Ed solo is medium up tempo, lower register stuff on the tenor over the percussion and over this really thudding bass riff that sort of just keeps rocking through the whole song. So I find this enjoyable. It does feel kind of meditative as a whole for the whole album as a general impression. It's not that far removed in some ways from The Missing Link. Ed's a more direct player than Anderson is. Anderson is much more bleak and kind of questing and wandering, and Ed plays things that are recognizable as melodies, whereas Fred Anderson doesn't really. So this is in some ways a more accessible album, maybe, than The Missing Link, but it's not that far away from it in some respects. a lot of stretched out meditative stuff, particularly that very long number Satya. But other things on here as well are pretty chill. Serenity. A song called Serenity going to be pretty mellow. I take it Nicole is playing some kind of flute. I don't know what Ed's playing there, but he's paired with her. He's doing something there. Yeah, this is pretty meditative, mellow stuff for the most part. Optimistic is in the same kind of bag. So yeah, missing link, but you know, for the uptight younger crowd, I don't know. I liked it. Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think, more textural variety, and there are moments of spiky energy here, and there are times where Ed will get out. And I think, you know, Ed's a really, he's a fine player. It's just, to some degree, like Fred and like Vaughn, a lot of Chicago players just, it may partially have to do with opportunity, and it may also have to do with philosophy, but they don't seem as focused on or concerned with documenting themselves, at least many of them, as their New York peers. It doesn't seem like the recordings are as central to what they're trying to achieve as artists. And, you know, they do record, but, you know, you look at Ed, you feel like a guy of that talent, he doesn't appear on as many records probably as he should. And I think, in a way, he's a generation or two younger, and probably just a little bit more flexible and able to do more things. It's you know, kind of hard to know. And I guess part of it is, you know, Vandermark, the great outstanding thing about him, at least certainly, I don't know if it's the case now, but 15 years ago or so, was he was just, you know, dedicated to rampantly getting his stuff down on tape. You know, there's a lot.
Yeah, he was a hustler. He was busy. He was always recording tons of stuff of himself or with, you know, his, you know, frequent collaborators. I mean, he was just a busy guy.
And I got to say, you know, when I heard him live this summer, in some ways, I thought that was the most interesting playing I've ever heard from him. So it's not that he hasn't been developing, and I'm not trying to like impugn his artistry, but just he, in terms of recordings, he had a more careerist or just focused bent on getting things on tape. And yeah, I don't know if this is important to these guys. I mean, Nicole has been out there and putting some stuff out, and she had a pretty well-reviewed album I'd love to hear out this year, last year, that I'm kind of curious about. But yeah, Ed's kind of been in the shadows. And this is an album that begins with kind of a loping post-bop tune. And I kind of like Chicago stuff where there is some of that, I don't know, just forward momentum. A great example would be the album by the cello player and Mary Halverson. I'm trying to think, what was her name?
Tamika Reed.
How could I forget? I mean, Tamika Reed, that I love that record because there's enough earth in the mix, enough groove in it, with the out feelings, and I just think it's my perfect brew. This one, there's some of that, and I think I remember at first I kind of bounced off this record because I hear that first tune and think I'm going to get something, you know, this well predates that, but something of that earthy mix, that groove, a little bit of the jazz impulse along with the out, and then it does get a lot more meditative. There are long stretches where it is just more exploratory and the chill vibe and kind of, it's about textures and auxiliary percussion, shimmering in the speakers on the far corners, and, you know, just kind of letting your mind go stuff. And there's a place for that. I just, you know, wasn't looking for it when I first got this record, and I felt a little bit like it was a bait and switch, and that first tune had more of the, I don't know, kind of jazz-oriented, groove-oriented stuff going, and then it kind of wandered off that. So it depends on what you're looking for. You know, I read a couple reviews of it, and one was 5 stars, one was like 2.5. And it was, my sense is, it was, well, what were they looking for? What were right. their expectations? And certainly, you know, as the AACM would get sometimes, they kind of wander off into their little instrument phases, and it would get very minimalistic and a little moment here and a moment there. Find that entrancing or you get bored. This, I think, has got a little bit more drive and texture than some of the spacier AACM moments, right. But it's in that lineage.
You've set You've used this term a couple of times, so you should explain what you're talking about. Little instrument. I think I know what you mean, but tell everyone
else.
Well,
you know, one thing that the AACM was known for was there'd be moments in their performances where their primary instrument, you know, the trumpet or the saxophone or whatever, would be put down, and they bring out, you know, small African percussion instruments or handmade instruments.
Triangles.
Or toys or just, you know,
right.
They might have 7 or 8 music-making devices that they kind of cycle through, and they tended to be quiet. They tended to be sometimes, as I said, they might be African, but they might also be Fisher-Price, or they might be homemade. Henry Threadgill, for a while, was playing like a hubcap phonium, which was a bunch of hubcaps that he lined up, and he would bang on when he wasn't playing his alto sax or his tenor sax or his flute. So, yeah, for whatever reason, I tend to think of that group as exploring that avenue of music making, where, you know, you could have a group like, say, Ornette Coleman's quartet, where Ornette played saxophone all the time until somebody showed him a trumpet. Then you wish to hell they'd stayed away from him. You know, where Albert Eiler played tenor sax. He didn't switch through a bunch of instruments. And most of the alternate instruments these guys would bring out were physically small. So that's where that term comes from. Little instruments.
Okay. Good, good.
So yeah, I think it's worth a listen, just so you know it exists. You may not want to look it up. You've heard some clips now, but there's this thing called frequency, and you can kind of track it down if you would, you know, Google Ed Wilkerson and the word frequency. But again, it's the kind of recording that makes itself as anonymous as humanly possible in this post-physical media age. You know, I guess you can find it on Spotify, unless Thrill Jockey doesn't play ball with them. I haven't looked, but how you locate it, I mean, as a search term, it does not work well.
No, that word is not going to help you much.
Well, are we going to go to the Green Mill? Are we ready for this?
Let's do the Green Mill.
Everybody sing along now.
This is an artist who does have a extensive and curated recorded legacy. I mean, this is a guy that has gone through half a dozen concepts as he's built out his catalog. And I think he's off Blue Note now, but he was there for quite a long time. This is an early Blue Note release when he was kind of, and he remains one of the handful of important male jazz vocalists in the last few decades, right? This is not a very crowded field, and he's certainly a major player in it. We've talked about Kurt before, twice, in fact. We talked about The Messenger on episode 15,
yep.
And then Upward Spiral, his collaboration with Branford Marsalis, on episode 118. So this is his third appearance. He's got the Jazz Bastard trifecta here.
I like this disc a lot, and I'm curious to know if you feel that this disc addresses what I take to be your one consistent minor critique of Elling that you've repeated a few times on the show. And that minor critique goes like this. He is, in Pat's terms, Pat always has very nice things to say about Elling in terms of his sheer artistry and control of his voice. He's a great, great, great singer. But Pat also sometimes humps that Elling is not the most sincere guy in the world, and that sometimes his singing is so extroverted that he doesn't seem to be fully invested. And I would note that you liked Upward Spiral more as an Elling production more than The Messenger. This is a live date, and one of the things that Elling partisans have often said is Elling must be experienced live, that the recordings aren't nearly as good as the studio recordings, aren't nearly as expressive or indicative of what Elling can do at a live date. And I'm just wondering if this disc addresses that issue for you, if you feel like, you know what, I do feel like he's invested. I do feel an emotional engagement here in some of his material that I sometimes have not felt listening to Elling's recorded output. What say you, Patrick?
Well, you know, at this time, I was actually on Kurt Elling's security detail. There have been threats against his life. And so when he arrived, it's like, the lizard is in the lounge. The lizard is... No, I think that he seems, in a sense, as he's a performer in his habitat, and he is seems less affected because he's, you know, he's doing what comes naturally to him, which is performing for an audience and enacting his hipster ways. And for the most part, showing off his jazz side. I mean, this is a very jazzy album. He's transforming the melodies. He's scatting extensively. He's sometimes improvising lyrics. It's about him stretching standards like taffy. And he's really good at that. And he doesn't have to kind of project sincerity to do it because he's sincerely interested in his musical explorations. So that works pretty well. Now, just to let you know that I'm not the only one that's ever had issues with him, I looked up a Jazz Times review of this particular album, and the first half of it is quite complimentary. It talks about his great technique and everything. Then it goes on to say, as in previous efforts, however, the CD tanks when Elling tries his hand at poetry, outfitting Wayne Shorter's Night Dream and Vince Mendoza's Esperanto with lyrics that sound like the collision of a hypersensitive middle school student and a rhyming dictionary. The Rent Party, a pseudo-Kerouac rap framing cameo appearances by saxophonist Von Freeman, Eddie Johnson, and Ed Peterson is even worse, reflecting the hipster wannabe sensibility that Lenny Bruce used to ridicule in his Hep Smoker Reefer routine. With Elling, one can never be quite sure whether the next spine tingle will be caused by pleasure or cringing. I did not have...
Jeez.
I know, this guy's like Knives Out, and I did not have this reaction to this album. I did not, and I've never had that strong reaction to what he's doing. His difficulty is that the persona he occupies to some degree is that of a 50s hipster. You can question, okay, well, it's 2000 or it's 2018. Isn't this, in a sense, an enactment of something that is in the past, right? I mean, there is a glass wall sense to it. That said, again, I think that he's at home here. I think that his voice, which is, you know, it's not the most traditionally beautiful voice. He's got great control of it. He does amazing things with it. Just in terms of its sheer sound, it's not necessarily, he's not a Bing Crosby or a Sinatra, somebody who's just blessed with a beautiful tone. It's perfect for the kinds of things he's doing with it here. You know, and he is very exploratory. He does a lot of really cool things. And I think they mostly come off really well. And, you know, I didn't mind the kind of Rent Party hipsterism, but again, it's an acting, a shtick that is, the point he's doing it, almost 50 years old, right? It's kind of reaching back to past models. But I'm just saying, other people have been bothered a lot more by Kurt than I am. Just to let you know. And I do think, for me, this is my favorite of his recordings. I think, you know, the Upward Spiral, obviously the performance we keep going on and on about of, what is it, Sensible Arrangement, A Rational, whatever. Yeah. You know, that's a pinnacle. But as a recording throughout, I think this is probably the best way to get to know him as a jazz man.
Yeah. He is one of the only people, maybe not the only person, but he's a champion of vocalese.
Solar with the scissor, fizzard, blizzard, wizard, gizzarding planets and sequence within like an avatar. While meanwhile, it turns styling and spinning over him. Spells be speaking, kingdoms in the dark calling me to yield, knighting me in a field covered with armies and with princes, all were signing, cannons shining, pennants flying. And when he spoke to me, he sang, and his words really rang.
And whatever the Jazz Times idiot reviewer had to say, apparently the Jazz Times idiot reviewer doesn't know or hasn't sourced where Elling gets his lyrics from, because Elling, when he does vocalese, almost never makes up stuff on his own. He tends to adapt or alter pre-existent poetry and fit it to the melody, and his sources are, impeccable. Rainer Maria Rilke, Pablo Neruda, St. John of the Cross. These are not what you would call juvenile rhymesters. So the Jazz Times reviewer can go fuck himself. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, and I didn't have, you know, just listening to it, I've heard a lot of painful vocalese in my time. Most of it is painful. And there is always that, and we've talked about it before, that extreme awkwardness of trying to fit language to instrumental lines that don't lend themselves to a verbal expression. You know, instrumentalists are playing music that wasn't supposed to be sung to. And when you try to cram syllables across it, it's very hard to come up with something that makes any coherent sense and then also has a flow or naturalness to it and kind of a rhythm matching, vowel sounds matching sense that you get with the best lyrics because, you know, they're written typically to music meant to be sung. But as that goes, I think this is a better example, not a worse example, that you're going to run across. I mean, I think most of it works pretty well.
I agree. And I, like I said, I think he avoids the obvious trap of juvenile lyrics by setting really fucking good poetry to these melodies. You know, I mean, it's adapted, but the source is actually pretty good. It's not some, you know, it's not Kurt jotting in his notebook at night, "How do I love me? Let me count the ways." You know, he's picked some pretty fucking A-list poetry to do this with. A whole bunch of things here I like. I've already, you know, I'm a partisan of his tone. I do like his tone. You're right. He's not a Bing Crosby crooner, but he has got an incredibly supple instrument in terms of his range is much bigger than you would think. And he's really good at various kinds of dynamics. He can sing, you know, quite softly in the upper range and it sounds really nice. So I actually really like the sound of his voice a great deal. And a couple of the numbers here are just showstoppers. There's a Sting cover and it's fucking brilliant. I mean, I just love that song. So he covers "Oh My God" and it's just him over percussion, which you think, okay, hipster douchebag time. And he fucking kills that song. I mean, I think he may single-handedly be making an argument for, you know, Sting as accomplished songwriter, just with the treatments that he gets. He's so much, you know, and Sting's not a bad singer, but his voice is shot at this point in his life. But Elling, when he covers this stuff, is fantastic. I thought "Oh My God" was one of the high points of this album, and it's just him over Khalil El-Sabar's percussion, who's, you know, an AACM dude. That's cool. And I don't know what you thought of it, but I thought the 12-minute "My Foolish Heart" was astonishing. It's really impressive. And that's the one where there's an extended middle section where he's actually adapted a poem by St. John of the Cross and has kind of worked it in over the instrumental accompaniment. And to me, that feels aching and heartfelt and real. It's an emotional high point, and it comes right after the opening song, you know. So it's like, this is a great way to start a concert. You know, it's like, let's all get invested right now. I thought it was fantastic. I think that's a really, really good number. The thing that didn't work as well for me, I've heard him do the stuff that he does in the Ren Party, and it's cute. It's interesting. I get that he's introducing Ed Peterson and Vonsky, and there's another Ed. He's introducing another tenor player here. Ed, I'll think of his name in a second. It's listed here. Oh, Eddie Johnson.
Yeah.
So he's introducing all those guys, and that's cool. And it's hipster and funny and clever and not that interesting to me. And of course, the closer, the blues chaser is funny, you know, where he says, you know, "Be sure to tip your waitstaff, and the more you drink, the better we sound."
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, really?
Yeah, it's club pattern.
He's doing his Tom Waits shtick there. Tom Waits does him. Anyway, those are when he seems his most extroverted and silly, but when he seems invested, God, is he good. So "My Foolish Heart" is wonderful. I hope you liked the vocalese, the "Night Dream," because I thought that was really nice. The Wayne Shorter
song.
Yeah,
it's a gorgeous tune. It really is.
Oh, yeah. It's just beautiful.
You know, Gregory Porter does a Wayne Shorter tune on like his first album, which is the most jazzy album he did. It's interesting. I don't know whether I'm sure that comes out after this. So it's just interesting that they both pick. I mean, enough Shorter in a sense is, I think, especially in academia, studied, and of course, I mean, I think he's well deservedly so. I mean, I love his stuff, but it's just interesting that, you know, both of them pick a Shorter tune to sing over.
Yeah, and the use of the old guard here, John Hendricks, the aforementioned tenor players, that's a regular deal for Elling, apparently, at the Green Mill. In that extended period when he was playing up there, he would routinely bring people up onto the stage. He'd play long sets, and he would bring people up onto the, you know, whoever was in town. And he had played with those guys before. Vonsky and Ed Peterson are old running mates. They've recorded a couple albums together. So even though he's got these guys up on the, you know, up on the stage with him, there is a sort of loose camaraderie. They all kind of know each other. They play well together. And I thought the number that he sang with John Hendricks worked really well as well.
You should be a scatterbrain, singing in the rain. Never feel the pain, never mean a thing to sleep before the president will bring. Understand, be a man, yes you can. If you want the Lord to share you, don't let nothing scare you. Share you, wear you, don't let nothing scare you.
I heard what you said, and I know you're trying to tighten my head. I'm telling you, Daddy, I don't mind the daytime. It's the run and rob and play time. But in the night, that's why this incident can give me a big fright.
That was pretty enjoyable stuff. So I like this date a whole bunch. I think it's awfully good. And I'm just a big Elling fan anyway. So, yeah, I thought this was quite good. And I hope you liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, I did.
Well.
You know, as I said, it's very much a live album. And it's not trying to just give you live performances, but rather the experience of going to a club show with Kurt. So there's the patter. There are the guest stars. You know, it's really trying to give you the vibe of being in the club, as opposed to saying we're going to take music recorded in a club and make a record out of it. It's like the record is of the club date. And so some of the things, yeah, some of the routines, you know, the fifth or sixth time you hear him explain Esperanza or whatever, it's less funny. You know, the story's great. It's well delivered, but it's a little bit of a, you might want to just fast forward past that. Because routine is not going to get any fresher. So the same with the ending stuff. So that's the kind of question of, it's great for flavor, but for a document that you want to return to again and again, a couple of the numbers are less valuable than most of them. But yeah, a couple are absolute showpieces. I think this reminded me in a way that I'm not sure the other records I've heard by him did, of what a great scatter he is, and how, you know, My Foolish Heart very much, this is grad school level jazz singing. I mean, he's pushing it places that if you don't know what you're doing could go horribly wrong. You know, we're almost in Betty Carter territory where he's really working those structures. And I think it comes off beautifully. That's him at his most adventuresome with the tradition. And he's somebody who has recorded albums that recast, you know, more contemporary things, Joe Jackson stepping out or whatever, a whole record of kind of that. He's done a lot of different looks. You know, I did read a review of a live appearance of recently saying, well, it was good to see him with Branford Marsalis because he was less, you know, he's been getting kind of in a rut and less and less adventuresome as a singer. I can't attest to that. I just have not been listening to all his records as they come out. So I don't know whether he's gotten more conservative. He's always been in kind of a tough place because that really aggressive vocalese hipster style of singing has never had a wide audience. I think in general, maybe men are in more of a box even than women. But of course, it's not like Betty Carter had thousands of people lined up to listen to her. It's a tough sell. I mean, I think people are more comfortable with adventuresome instrumentalists than they are singers. So, you know, it's a little harder to find an audience if you're going to really push things and not kind of just sing the tune with maybe a little ornamentation. But yeah, I think this is a good record. Again, it's, I think the main things, one, if any whiff of hipsterism drives you crazy, like the Jazz Times reviewer, you're still going to have trouble with much of what Elling does. That is part of what he does, is this kind of Tom Waits shtick. But it's a document of, you know, I think this is an album you could play for people to say, you know, why is Kurt Elling considered one of the great male jazz vocalists of the last couple decades? This explains that in a nutshell. You don't have to like go further. This is all you need to hear. And you realize, okay, that's why.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad it's not been too much Elling for you, because I know this was, you know, the third time with something, Pat starts to get restless.
Yeah.
You were relatively pleased.
It's a great honor. You know, if you appear here three times, you can just retire at that point, or maybe leave the country. I don't know.
Yeah, well, fans talk to Gregory Porter about how he feels about his third appearance.
That's right.
On our
so well. I haven't panned Kurt yet. Yeah.
Well, so it's a three-timer. Abra, Akimusere. There's a handful of three-timers.
Yeah, and, you know, we've probably done Miles three times, but not.
Well, we should probably do Miles 100 times, but yeah, okay.
Ellington probably. I don't know if we've done Coltrane that often. Anyway, yeah, it's a rare honor or curse to be on this podcast more than twice.
For a living musician to appear for the third time on The Bastards.
Really, if they appear four times, they're no longer living musicians. They just give up. Oh, God, no. There's another one of these.
We've surely talked about three Maldow albums at this point. God. I don't know.
Yeah, well, he's just, mainly he's got the restraining order on Mike. That's the main thing he knows. He's
like, whatever.
His PR agent keeps saying, he doesn't have a body pillow. Leave him alone. There is no Brad Meldow. No, we don't make one. We don't endorse one. Go away. Start playing him in every dream house a heartache, and then he'll realize what the problem is.
Mr. Tillman, good to see you again. There's a few outstanding charges. Just before we check you in, let's see here. You left your passport in the mini fridge and a message with the desks. Here the picture isn't, oh, just a reminder about our policy. Don't leave your mattress in the rain.
Well, speaking of Roxy music, any pop matters on your mind? Anything?
Oh, what have I been listening to lately? I'm trying to figure out. Let's see. I don't think I have any pop matters worthy of the mention. When I look at what I've been recently listening to, none of it is going to appeal to you. Much of it is going to make you sick to your stomach, I think.
Oh, God, okay.
I've listened to, yeah, it's been more of a, for whatever reason, still making my way through that REM set, which, God, it's great. Yeah, there's been a lot of what they call Americana or roots rock, but also sort of, you know, just plain fucking country, I guess is the only way to put it. So nothing you really want to hear about, I don't think. So you tell me what you've been listening to.
Well, nothing in depth. I have Spotify'd about half of Father John Misty's latest God's Favorite Customer. I can't decide yet. I might be ready to love again. You know, his debut is one of my favorite records of the last decade. And then the next two didn't do much for me. He seemed to get a lot preachier, and I just don't find him interesting in that mode at all. So this one is fucked up but more introspective, and maybe the sense of humor is coming back in a way that I appreciate it. I don't know. I've not, the whole performance art thing he's done with the public and his interviews and his persona, don't care about, haven't followed. Couldn't give a shit, but I do love that first Fear Fun. I love that record to death, and I'm hoping this one will grow on me enough that I want to get it. And then the endless reissue factory of the Beatles, they've now come up to the White Album. It's got its 50th anniversary, and so they're reissuing a remaster of that, and I thought, well, there's a 4 LP set that has that, and what are called, I didn't know about these before, I'm not really a Beatleologist. The Escher demos, where apparently they did, you know, they're just demos of most or many of the songs on the White Album and a couple tunes that didn't make it. Junk, which later appeared on like McCartney's first solo album or somewhere along there. And this weird Sour Milk Sea song by George Harrison that, as far as I know, never appeared anywhere. And I thought, well, that might be cool. For instance, I ranted and raved about how much I loved the alternate Tusk album by Fleetwood Mac. I like it better than the original. So I listened to some of these again on Spotify, and I think I decided this. My rule with the Beatles is almost everything they recorded and released officially, I like, and I've just almost heard nothing that wasn't released during the lifetime of their organization that I found of much interest. It seems like they knew what they were doing. They did it. And everything leading up to it, just, I don't know, maybe I don't love them enough. I just, you know. And so I thought these demos, oh, they're going to be so personal and sensitive. And in a sense, the White Album is the album where you feel like, for the first time, really, there's something more immediate or personal, or I don't know, just, it's like, as human beings, it's as close as you get to the Beatles, I feel like, that particular record, right? There's a vulnerability about much of the music on that album that is almost nowhere else in their oeuvre. I mean, mostly they're just incredibly accomplished. And of course, you know, John's always agonizing about this or that. But even he is just he's a pro from the very young age. And there's a kind of persona about it. McCartney, I don't know that he's got an inner life. I mean, he's just doing his thing and being a songbird. But the White Album, you know, there's something about it that seems more, you know, a little screwed up, personal, off-kilter, just kind of exposed. And I thought, well, maybe those demos are going to have more of that. And they don't really. You know, the ones I've listened to, it's like, okay, this is the singer of that song playing it on acoustic guitar, but it doesn't seem more naked or expressive. It seems less so. It's like, here's what the song's supposed to sound like, guys. What do you think? Are we going to put it on or not? So I don't think I'm going to get that, but we'll see. Maybe I'll change my mind.
Okay. Right on.
That's all I got to report. Includes Jazz Bastard episode 154. We've dedicated this episode to Lee, and that's why we're playing some music from Duke Ellington's And His Mother Called Him Bill, as Ellington was one of Lee's favorites. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or at pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you wish, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, or if you like, you can stream it on All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we do an episode devoted to Roy Hargrove. Till next time, take care.